All rise. Just a quick report from the state of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Justice Perry presiding.
Good morning. Go ahead and be seated.
Morning, Your Honor.
Morning, Your Honor.
So loud when you're standing right there.
What?
When you're standing right there, it's really loud.
Good morning. As you'll see, let's see, I don't know that, can we see Justice Pickering in Las Vegas? Okay, Justice Pickering is appearing from Las Vegas. Chris, I can't see you, but I assume you're there.
Yep, I'm down here.
Okay.
And I think you should be able to see me now.
Very good. Now I can see you.
Okay, thank you.
Our first matter on today, docket number 89642, Abraxas Petroleum versus Watson. Counsel, are we ready?
We are, Your Honor.
Appellant's ready, Your Honor.
Okay, come on up and would you like to reserve any time?
Your Honor, if I could reserve 5 minutes, I'd be grateful. Would you like me to make an appearance, Your Honor?
Yes, please.
Chris Clark, Clark Smith Villazor, for the appellant, Abraxas Petroleum. With me is my partner, Michael Sala, and our local counsel, Chelsea Latino. I'd also like to thank that my mother, Kathleen Kirk, is in the courtroom from Sacramento for the first time in 30 years of law practice to watch me argue.
Welcome. Welcome.
And may it please the court, we're ready to begin.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. We're here on a grant of summary judgment, finding that Mr. Watson adequately perfected his dissenter's rights in relation to a short-form merger conducted by Abraxas. That grant was error for at least three reasons. The first being the trial court overlooked the governing standard and prerequisites contained in NRS 92A-420. Secondly, she misconstrued the definition of shareholder contained in the NRS. And third, she overlooked applicable requirements contained in NRS 92-400. I'd like to start with just a couple of these stipulated facts in this case, because we have a stipulated record, and I think they're pretty significant, particularly given the erroneous definition of shareholder applied by the trial court. Mr. Watson is a shareholder, and he is both a beneficial shareholder and a shareholder of record of Abraxas Petroleum. And that is stipulated at Joint Appendix 24, paragraph 8. There is some confusion in the record from the trial court about that, but that those are unassailable facts that were stipulated by the parties. He is both. So when Mr. Watson sought to perfect his dissenter's rights, he needed to turn to NRS 92. And in particular, he needed to turn to NRS 92 A-420, which is titled Prerequisites to Demand for Payment for Shares. And this is a very simple case and a very simple resolution using very simple terminology that's all stipulated. And if we look at subsection 3 of NRS 92A-420, it says what a shareholder must do in order to be entitled to payment for his shares under the chapter. It says, a stockholder who does not satisfy the requirements of subsection 1 or 2, meaning of section 420, and NRS 92A-400 is not entitled to payment for his or her shares under this chapter. That provision no way distinguishes between beneficial shareholders and shareholders of record, and it lays out three unavoidable requirements to qualify for payment.
Mr. Clark, though, does it make any sense to you that if DTC did not consent to the sale of the 1,000 shares, then Mr. Watson would have been unable to exercise dissenter's rights as to the other 579,000 plus shares?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I mean, if you're asking me a policy question, I'm happy to get back to the statutory interpretation, which is very clear. But if you're asking me a policy question, the answer is yes. A, this statute and every other state statute relating to appraisals do not allow share splitting. And the reason why is because a corporation is supposed to be able to, shortly, especially after a short form merger, to know who's dissenting, how much, and where. And the AeroGrow case, I think, is a great example of the law relating to your policy argument, which is AeroGrow from this court requires strict compliance with the requirement that a shareholder of record consent.
But before you move over to strict compliance, and we can talk about that in a while, I want to talk about the language specifically in 92A 420. First of all, you concede that this did not go to shareholder vote, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So paragraph 1 of 92A 420 does not apply?
Correct.
And then paragraph 2, you would also concede that this was not submitted for approval pursuant to a written notice ahead of the short form merger occurring. So there was no solicitation of consent. The notice was after the merger had occurred and was a fait accompli. Is that correct?
That's the situation, Your Honor. That's why I'm talking about section 3.
Well, but you're divorcing subsection 3 from 1 and 2. If subsection 2, by its terms, applies to a proposed corporate action, which the word proposed implies future, not fait accompli, and then it says is taken without a vote of the stockholders or submitted for approval pursuant to a written consent, there was no submit to approval without a written consent that preceded the merger. So there was no vote and no opportunity for a shareholder to split up the vote and vote some and not the others. So I'm not sure that subparagraph 2 applies either, read literally.
I'm not quibbling with Your Honor. My point is subparagraph 3 refers the dissenter and the court to section 400.
And but if sub, do you agree with me then that subparagraph 2 does not apply to this situation?
Your Honor, I think there's an argument that subparagraph 2B can apply and that the tendering of shares works as a consent to the corporate action.
But if even after it's, it must not consent to or approve the proposed corporate action. So that implies that they had notice that this was going to happen and they were, their consent was solicited.
Well, no, Your Honor.
Their approval sought and neither of those things occurred.
Again, we're relying on section 3, but I want to address Your Honor's question. Under section 2, you have the consent requirement. The option that a dissenting shareholder has when there is no vote is to not tender. This gentleman decided to do that as to certain shares. By tendering, you're giving up any objection and you are actively consenting. So that's not our main argument. Go, Your Honor, you have a question. Sorry.
So then you think that subparagraph 2 applies to this situation, even though the merger was a fait accompli before any notice of it was given to the shareholders?
I do, but I think for much more direct reasons, Your Honor, the dissenter failed to perfect, which is section 3 of 92A 420 requires compliance with section 400.
But if the requirements don't apply, okay, move to 400. Let's
but,
go.
But, Your Honor, I don't mean to argue with Your Honor, but Section 3 is a completely separate section that is not modified by any of the voting issues that Your Honor's identified in Subsection 2. Subsection 3 just says if a shareholder fails to do X or Y, so it fails to comply with one or two above, for the sake of argument, let's say they did, they must also comply with Section 400. And so
okay.
Section 400 says, A, that he, in section 2A, he must submit to the subject corporation the written consent of the stockholder of record to the dissent not later than the time the beneficial stockholder asserts dissenter's rights. He failed to do that. It is stipulated that he failed to do that. He did not do that. So he did not comply with Section 400. It's in the record stipulated at paragraph 36 of the stipulated facts. So he's out. But more significantly, and getting back to the policy argument, Your Honor, Section 1...
But subsection... Let me stop you at 92A402.
Yes?
Your point is that this builds it back into 420, that they need to... Subparagraph B says he must do so with respect to all shares of which he or she is the beneficial stockholder or over which he or she has the power to direct the vote. And in this case, the stockholder did not do so as to the shares of which they were a beneficial stockholder, but it's a stretch, isn't it, to read that as applicable to the shares as to which the stockholder is a record stockholder?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I was talking about Section A, but I'm happy to talk about Section B. No, it's not a stretch, because again, and what's gone on here, unfortunately, is a lot of reading of terms into the statute. Section B says, does so with respect to all shares of which he or she is the beneficial stockholder or over which he or she has the power to direct the vote. It doesn't say, or all beneficial shares under which he or she has the power to direct the vote. It says all, because it's trying to eliminate splitting. That's why this provision is in the statute. And if it meant just the beneficial shares, it would say so. But it doesn't.
What's the policy reason for eliminating splitting? Isn't it that you don't want somebody to influence the outcome of a corporate action in part and then benefit of it later by taking an inconsistent, in other words, self-serving votes? And if they don't have an opportunity to influence that, why does the law care?
The model code and Delaware law say differently, and we don't have a statement from Nevada. And the model code and Delaware law say the reason is to give a corporation early and adequate notice of the resources it has to conserve concerning the merger, and that by splitting shares, you leave it open as it is now. I mean, we had a finding that we failed to pay Mr. Watson because he was somehow both, yes, a record holder and no, not a record holder. Yes, a beneficial holder, and no, not a beneficial holder. So the corporation can't resolve these issues in a timely manner. We're years away from the merger, and we haven't resolved these issues yet. And so the purpose of vote splitting is to say, you are in or you are out. The purpose of appraisal rights is to say, if you want to exit the corporation, you exit entirely. There are legions of Delaware cases on this issue. The model code talks about it. If you want to stay in, you stay in and you get your appraisal, or rather you stay in as a shareholder. But splitting shares causes exactly what this case has caused, which is enormous delay, expense, and uncertainty in transactions that the appraisal rights provisions are designed to try to make mergers fast and final. This was a short form merger, but I want to really concentrate on this because I think it's very important. Subsection 2B of 400 says, not over all the shares of which he's a beneficial shareholder. It says over which all the which shares he has the power to direct the vote. There is no dispute in this case that Mr. Watson had the power to direct the vote over all his record and all his beneficial shares. And he admittedly failed to dissent as to the beneficial shares. After that, we look back at 420. And it says, if you don't satisfy the requirements of 400, you don't get paid.
So, Mr. Clark, let me ask you a question. Under 2B, if Mr. Watson had asserted his right to dissent over the beneficial shares, but not the shares that he was the stockholder of record, would that be a problem?
Under 2B, Quite possibly, but it would be absolutely a problem under three, and that's what I'm trying, continuing to try to direct the court to section three.
No, under 92A400, sorry.
92A400, sorry, I apologize, Your Honor.
There's too many 2As.
I wasn't following you. Sorry, 92A2B? Of course, absolutely, Your Honor, because he would have failed to dissent as to all the shares over which he controlled the vote.
But okay, but when you read this, it says, does so with respect to all shares over which he or she is the beneficial stockholder, right?
Right.
It doesn't require it to be all, it could just have said all.
Sorry, Your Honor. He does so with respect to share all the shares of which he's a beneficial stockholder.
Right.
Or over which he or she has the power to direct the vote. He's required to do that as to all his shares. This, the statute abhors splitting. Whether the court wants to get into the fact that this state doesn't have any written down policy about why it does, that's the entirety of the reason of section one when it comes to record holders. So yes, then he would have a problem with section one if it were the record shares that were flipped around as opposed to the beneficial shares. Section one tries to prevent vote splitting with regard to record shares. You have to vote all the shares in one person's name of the same class as a record holder, and section two looks at beneficial shares. And the purpose of this section is to eliminate exactly what happened here. And there, you cannot square section 2B with what this litigant did.
You may want to reserve for your last couple minutes.
I do, Your Honor, and actually I want to come back and talk about fees at that time. Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors.
Morning.
Yep. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Max Vaitaz, and I represent the respondent, Robert Watson, in this matter. The district court got it right. It used the canons of statutory construction and correctly interpreted NRS Chapter 92A. The district court didn't create an exception. Instead, it accepted and enforced the plain text of the statutes. Abraxas seeks to marginalize Mr. Watson, the founder and former CEO, for his proper dissent of over 500,000 record shares because he did not perfect his dissent for 1,000 shares he held as a beneficial stockholder in his E-Trade account. That is not Nevada law, and Abraxas can point to no case or statute to support its theory. NRS Chapter 92A-420 is inapplicable because there was no proposed corporate action for Mr. Watson to vote on, consent to, or approve. This was a no-notice short-form merger that took place before Mr. Watson was even notified. NRS Chapter 92A400 is equally inapplicable because subsection 1 deals with nominee record stockholders, which Mr. Watson is not, and subsection 2 deals with beneficial stockholders, which Mr. Watson is not seeking appraisal rights for. NRS Chapter 92A defines two distinct types of stockholders, a beneficial stockholder or a record stockholder, and nothing in NRS Chapter 92A binds a record stockholder's dissenter's rights to a beneficial stockholder's dissenter's rights. This is true in any situation, even one where a single person is both types of stockholders. Abraxas is lost on this distinction, but this court nor the district court should be lost on that issue. Accordingly, Mr. Watson respectfully requests that this court affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment and affirm the attorney's fees award.
What do you say to your colleague across the aisle's argument with respect to 92A402B, where he's positing that requires complete tender or assertion of dissenters' rights as to both record and beneficial shares?
Well, I would respectfully disagree with my colleague on the other side of the aisle's argument there, Your Honor. First and foremost, subsection 2 of 400, it deals specifically just with beneficial stockholders. It's beneficial. It's a beneficial stockholder subsection. There's no mention of record stockholders at all. And what Abraxas is attempting to do is inject record stockholders into that last clause of subsection 400. But I think if you honestly read the subsection and view it in the whole light of the subsection dealing with beneficial stockholders, I think the word direct is critical here. A beneficial stockholder does have the power to direct the vote. As Your Honors know, the beneficial stockholder is the one that needs to go to the nominee record stockholder to direct whether to get consent for the merger or not to get consent for the merger. A record stockholder doesn't need to direct anything. A record stockholder just votes. A record stockholder gives no direction because they're the one that gets to make that decision. So I would respectfully disagree with Abraxas's position to try to use that last clause in subsection 2 of NRS 400 to imply that somehow a record stockholder is now part of that subsection. And that brings me, you know, again to 420, and I listened to the discussion earlier, and clearly, and both sides are agreeing that 420 subsection 1 does not apply in this situation because there is no vote. But equally, subsection 2 does not apply, again, because there was no proposed corporate action. This was a no-notice short-form merger. Again, and I think Your Honors pointed this out already, but it begs to repeat, the merger occurred on June 14th, 2023. The merger notice was mailed June 16th, 2023. So Mr. Watson had no advance notice, no ability to review the merger or approve or consent to it. The notice actually confirmed that Mr. Watson was not required or permitted to approve the merger and advised Mr. Watson his ability to exercise his dissenter's rights. And that's answer to question 4 in the notice of merger in the joint appendix at page 38. And again, Abraxas made choices here. Abraxas chose not to hold a vote or seek the consent of the minority stockholders. Abraxas chose not to send an advance notice statement to the minority stockholders under NRS 92A410. Of course, under our statutory scheme, that advance notice is discretionary. Abraxas chose not to do that. So again, as a result, there is no proposed corporate action. And it would make no sense to require Mr. Watson to somehow comply with 420 when there was no action, proposed action for him to approve or consent to. And NRS 92A420 does not apply and cannot be used to marginalize Mr. Watson. And that's true for both Mr. Watson's record shares or his shares in his E-Trade account. It doesn't matter that Mr. Watson received the merger consideration for his 1,000 shares while he was wearing his beneficial stockholder hat because there was no proposed corporate action for him to consent or approve. And again, the statute must be read in full. And again, my friend on the other side of the aisle would like the court to ignore subsections 1 and 2 and just focus on 3. But you have to look at the entirety of the statute, and the Blackburn v. State decision requires that. Shifting, you know, over to 400, we've talked about subsection 2, but with regards
before you move over there, what is the policy as you perceive it for requiring that in for penny, in for pound, you do the whole tender if you're going to vote in favor or vote on or consent to a proposed corporate action?
Well, I think there's a statutory argument that the Nevada legislature has set up the fact that stockholders can wear both a stockholder of record hat and a beneficial stockholder hat. And so it allows, and it doesn't define them by individuals or persons. And Delaware does do that. And again, that's why we also submit that Delaware is not applicable here because their statutory scheme is different. But Nevada has kept their definitions of the beneficial stockholder and the record stockholder at the Model Act that was enacted back in 1984. They have not changed that. The Nevada legislature has kept those definitions the same. But I think the policy argument, Your Honor, is actually, candidly, it runs more in favor of Mr. Watson, because if Mr. Watson's rights to dissent for his 500,000 record shares were tethered, right, to his shares held as a beneficial stockholder, his ability to perfect his dissent for those record shares would be in the hands of a third-party nominee for his beneficial shares. So effectively, what would be happening is we would be allowing another stockholder of record, this nominee stockholder over here, to effectively control the rights of dissent of another stockholder of record, just because they may wear two different hats. So I think policy-wise, it would defeat the whole concept of the stockholder of record being the party that decides things and is the one that makes votes and does things with their stock, and then being able to then say, well, this nominee record stockholder, they can decide not to give their consent, and then in turn frustrate a valid record stockholder for his own dissent. And I think that runs afoul to the case law in this state, specifically American Ethanol, which again states that the dissenter's rights statutes are to protect the minority stockholders. And that would greatly hinder a stockholder of record's ability to dissent. Your Honor, I think what I'd like to do is just briefly speak on just the Nevada case law, because again, that, you know, there is the statutory directive under 78012 that, you know, limits our look to Delaware and New York, which is what Abraxas would like this court to do. But just to speak to the Nevada case law, because again, I think most of it is inapplicable for this situation where we have Mr. Watson sitting both as a record stockholder and a stockholder of record. As the court knows in Kasorin, the court decided that the beneficial stockholders were to receive, or excuse me, the record stockholders are to receive notice, not the beneficial stockholders. Again, inapplicable here, not really at issue. But my friend on the aisle did mention the AeroGrow decision. And so I think briefly, the result that Mr. Watson's asking for very much comports with what AeroGrow did, because AeroGrow, again, was this court was looking at a situation where there was notice given, right? Here, there was no notice. There was no affording of the minority to go ahead and decide whether they wanted to consent or approve the merger. And then finally, I would just state that, you know, Cohen would is not applicable given the fact that was dealing with the you know, exclusive remedy in NRS 92A. Unless Your Honors have any more questions, I'm happy to shift just briefly to the attorney's fees issue. You know, we submit that the district court also got it right when it awarded Mr. Watson his attorney's fees. When Abraxas refused to recognize Mr. Watson as a dissenter and pay him at his estimated fair value under 92A460, he had to file suit. And because he prevailed, the district court properly awarded him all of his, you know, expenses that he was statutorily entitled to under 92A500 subsection 5, including costs and attorney's fees. And awarding a prevailing dissenter in such an action with all expenses of the suit makes sense and is sound in policy, because those expenses were only incurred because Abraxas failed to comply with its statutory obligations. This statute serves to deter corporations from further marginalizing minority stockholders by thwarting their efforts to dissent to a corporate action. The plain text of 92A500 confirms the intent of the legislature.
How are we supposed to read the statute looking at what seems like interchangeable use of terms, right? So they use cost, they use expenses and fees. How do we give meaning to each of those terms in this statute?
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, that in this particular situation, the use of all expenses was very intentional, because this is a statutorily required payment that the corporation needs to make in order for the minority stockholder to even proceed down the dissenter's rights path, where these other terms, like you're mentioning, Your Honor, attorney's fees and things, will come into play. And in order for that stockholder to even get to that later point, this payment needs to be made as far as the steps in this dissenter's rights process go. And so we would submit that the all expenses is intended to be all encompassing for anything that this stockholder is having to do in order to get that payment made, so then they can then become a dissenter and then have the fair value petition filed by the corporation. And I think the district court was really profound in how it recognized that interpreting expenses to exclude attorney's fees, because again, Abraxas is not quibbling with the costs being subsumed into the term expenses, just attorney's fees. The district court stated that, you know, interpreting expenses to exclude attorney's fees would implicitly add the phrase "except attorney's fees" to the statute. And so that obviously is not a result permitted under Nevada law. And so we would submit that clearly the use of all expenses is incredibly intentional, given the gravity of the payment of the fair value that needs to be made in order for this minority stockholder to then continue going down the path of dissent.
What do you say to your opposing counsel's citation of the Peter versus Nankwest case? It's a United States Supreme Court case from 2019 that expenses doesn't mean fees unless, because you have the rule that each side pays its own fees, unless there's an express provision for payment of fees in the statute you're looking at.
And what I would say to Your Honor, and of course understand the concept there that's being promoted as the American rule, but what I would say to that, Your Honor, again, is the gravity of what the minority stockholder who is already sitting there, I'm not going to say disenfranchised, but I think marginalized because they were not paid the fair value, even though they believe they effectuated the procedure for the dissenter's process, and then being able to require the company to pay those expenses that the minority had to incur just to get that payment and continue down that process.
And under the current version of the model code, would the attorney's fees unmistakably be recoverable in this context?
I don't believe we've adopted the current version of the model code under NRS 500. Let me just check one reference point, Your Honor.
It looks like we sort of did, but didn't quite do it all the way.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. I think, you know, when we're getting past this fair value payment, and then getting towards the later dissenters process and the appraisal process, we're getting the fees and costs then get a little bit more specific, because there are instances, and as Your Honor knows, can I finish responding?
Go ahead and finish, yes.
As Your Honor knows, that there's a final, lost my train of thought there. There's the, in the statutes, there are the cost portion that the court will automatically grant because the court can appoint its own appraisers. And so there's a distinction between allowing that, but then not allowing fees, but only allowing fees if there's some sort of vexatiousness or nefariousness that's going on. So again, thank you, Your Honors. We request affirmance of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you.
May I, Your Honor?
Yes.
Thank you. It's remarkable that counsel didn't reference the statute. It's NRS 92A500. Justice Pickering is correct. The American rule, as set forth very clearly in Peter versus Nyquist, is you need to specify fees if different. We have a practical demonstration of the legislature doing that in Section 500 about this claim. So when it comes to this claim, it's undisputed that fees were awarded under Section 5 of Section 500, which says you can get all expenses of the suit. Under Peter versus Nyquist, that doesn't get it. But more importantly, this statute, this section, in Sections 2, A and B, call out when you get fees and expenses. So in Section 2, it says the court may assess the fees and expenses of the council, but their fee award was under Section 5, which explicitly doesn't do that.
Does this create an ambiguity in the statute? Is it ambiguous, and should we look to legislative history in this instance?
It's not ambiguous at all, because the United States Supreme Court has said unless you say fees, it doesn't mean fees. But if you look to the legislative history, I think, again, as Justice Pickering was pointing out, the model code provides for fees in a situation like this. And the legislature declined to adopt that. And that, under Nevada law, is preclusive evidence of their intent not to provide fees. We cite all of the cases in our briefs on this issue. It's in the model code. They didn't put it in specifically. It's preclusive proof they didn't need
to. It matters that it says all expenses, because when I think about just practically what all expenses mean, if I'm going to file a lawsuit, it would include paying the attorney, right?
Under American law, it doesn't. Under Peter versus Nyquist, it doesn't. This statute, in sections directly above what Your Honor's talking about, says fees and expenses. Why did the legislature need to see fees and expenses two sections above if expenses means fees?
What does all mean?
All means all of your expenses, as are usually taxed in cases. So you get, just like in an offer a judgment case, you get your filing fees, you get your brief fees, you get your experts, but you don't get your attorney's fees.
But why
aren't those costs?
Those are also costs. This court taxed costs.
So what's the difference?
You don't get attorney's fees when you tax costs of this court.
What's the difference between expenses and costs? And why did they use the word all there?
They use the word all because all of those expenses are recoverable under Section 5.
Right, but they don't use the word all in front of costs. They don't say all costs. They use all one time to modify expenses in Section 5. Why? What does it mean?
Your Honor, it means you get all of your expenses, not just as someplace it's talking about, you get your appraisal fees. But in America, under Supreme Court precedent and under this statute, when it means fees, it means fees. It says fees in Section 2. Why would the legislature not just put that in Section 5 if they meant fees? But Nevada law is preclusive that if we had adopted the Model Act and excised fees from the Model Act and then put it in here, that's an expression of legislature's intent, and it's preclusive, and we've cited those cases to this court. If you want to have fees granted, the legislature knows how to do it. They showed us in this statute. Thank you. Thank you very much for your attention.
All right. Counsel, thank you for the briefing. It was excellent briefing in this case. Appreciate the arguments. Matter will stand submitted. We'll stand in recess until 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.